Hi, everybody. My name is John Rosani, and I want to welcome you to the Myers Way podcast, where we explore the leading edge of health and wellness. Today on the show, we have Dan Pardee and Dr. Amy Myers. Dr. Myers is a functional MD in Austin with extensive training in functional medicine, integrative medicine, and nutrition, and founder of Austin Ultra Health. Amy, you there?
I'm here. How are you, John?
Good. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling great. It's a good Friday.
Yeah, I'm very, very excited about this podcast. I'm going to pass it over to you.
Awesome. Well, I met Dan this year at Paleo FX and really just hit it off. He's an incredible guy, very warm and caring. And we started talking about sleep, of which he is an expert in sleep. And I was actually having some difficulties with my sleep. And I implemented a lot of the things that we're going to talk about today on this podcast. And they dramatically changed my sleep habits and I'm feeling much better. So I'm really excited to have Dan here. And I'm going to let him tell us a little bit about himself before we get into kind of the discussion around sleep. Dan, you there?
I am.
Welcome.
Thank you, Amy, John. Really happy to be on the show. And so I am a sleep researcher, and I work with the departments of neurology and endocrinology at Leiden University in the Netherlands. And I work with the behavioral sciences department at Stanford. And I look at things like how sleep influences hormones that are related to eating behavior and energy regulation. And I also look at how sleep influences cognitive processes like mood, information processing, decision making, which is really fascinating and very complex. And so it's sleep is something that I'm steeped in on a daily basis, and something that over time I've actually really grown quite affectionate towards, because it's a fascinating area that offers a lot of insights into how the mind and body work.
Absolutely. And it is a hot topic really for, I know, a lot of my patients. Fatigue is probably the number one complaint that I get in my clinic. And of course, there can be all kinds of reasons for that, you know, thyroid, vitamin deficiencies, food sensitivities, but sleep, number of hours of sleep, quality of sleep, that's definitely, I know, affecting people in terms of their fatigue and other health issues that they're having. So it seems like from what I know, really the amount of sleep that we're all getting on average has really decreased over time. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So we're getting about 20% less sleep on average than we were in 1960. So in 1960, self-reports indicated that the average was about 8.5 hours of time in bed per night. And the first investigation in sleep time that I was able to find in the literature was from 1906. And that indicated that people at that time were getting around the same amount, so around 8.5 hours of time in bed per night. Since 1960s, however, there's been a kind of continuous decrease. So if you look at the various reports that happen every few years that try to assess this on a population level, you see that the averages are going down. So most recent reports from the National Sleep Foundation show that on average, we're getting about just about 6.5 hours of sleep per night during the week. And then a little bit over 7, so like 7 hours and 20 minutes on the weekend. So people are trying to play catch up. And, you know, when you look at the literature, that decrease, the amount of that decrease is to a level that is really significant. So if you study sleep restriction and sleep deprivation in clinical studies, you can see that that degree of impairment has very significant outcomes. And so, it certainly has, sleep has, you know, a massive effect on all physiological systems throughout the body. And, you know, I think when we're not getting enough sleep, then certain people have vulnerability points, and people can, you know, it can certainly exacerbate a pre-existing condition. It can create one, and it can also just lead to a general feeling of malaise, fatigue, depressed mood. You know, so it's very, you know, very significant. And I think having a discussion about sleep and actually making it a really fundamental part of your health practice is a very smart thing to do. So, you know, I'm excited to talk about some of the specific issues and then practice points that people can, you know, try to implement in their life to make it better.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like not only are we having the decreased number of hours, but likely decreased quality as well. I mean, being bombarded with, you know, we'll get into this, but the the unnatural lights, the computers. I mean, I know me, I say I have two jobs. I go and work and then I come home and work out or do whatever, fix some dinner. And then I sit down to my second job, which is writing blogs and editing podcasts and things like that. So,
yeah.
You know, being bombarded with computers and cell phones and iPads, and everybody's reading on an iPad now. So I would imagine, and then stresses and food sensitivities and all the things that I deal with in my practice, not only are we having less sleep, but I imagine we're having less quality sleep as well.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a good saying by David Dinges, who's the editor of Sleep. I've heard him say this at a sleep conference, that morning alarm clocks and evening television have replaced sunrise and sunset as daily regulators of sleep timing and duration, right? So we're no longer having our sleep regulated by these, you know, the natural cycle, but rather by, you know, artificial stimulation. So whether that be waking up with an alarm clock or artificially being alerted at in the evening because of artificial light. I know we're going to take a little bit of a deeper dive into that later. But so, you know, your sleep, the overall quality of sleep is, what's important for sleep is timing, intensity, and then duration. So timing is when sleep occurs within a 24-hour period. All right, duration is then obviously the amount of total time that you sleep within a 24-hour period. And then intensity is the depth and the quality. You can, you know, there are markers of quality of sleep. So unfortunately, sometimes the conversation around quality is trying to identify one particular stage that is important and then trying to optimize some sort of situation so that you are maximizing that stage of sleep. But really, you know, sleep is a very complex and dynamic process. So the brain goes, you know, before sleep research began, it was thought that sleep was just this behaviorally quiescent period. So the brain and the body would just quiet down and rest. But we now know that, you know, sleep is very active. There's a lot, you know, we're moving between different stages over the course of the night. And each stage has a purpose. And even the transitions between stages seems to be important for certain processes like memory formation or hormone release, immune system resetting. So all, I think getting good quality sleep actually happens by us being smart during the day. And I'll kind of explain what I mean by that later. And then trying to facilitate good habits around bedtime, so before bed, and then also creating a good sleep environment that is going to allow uninterrupted sleep over the course of the night. But how we use our brain and our body during the course of the day is going to influence what happens at night. And a good example of that is my friend Marcos Frank, who's a professor at University of Pennsylvania. He does what's called monocular deprivation studies. So he will blind one eye and then he'll look. So basically, you're only getting information over the course of the day from one eye because the other side has a patch on it. And then they'll study brain activity at night during sleep. And you can see that the eye that was open has a lot more activity, that side of the brain, right? Because the optic chiasm, which is where the nerves enter the brain, they cross over. So if you blind the right eye, right? Or if you have the right eye open, then the left part of the brain is going to be very active at night. And that is illustrative of the idea that, you know, what you do in terms of like the information that you take in and how you use your brain during the day is then going to subsequently affect how the brain works at night and how it responds to that activity. And so, yeah, I'll leave it there for now because that's kind of like a deeper discussion. But, you know, we can go into that in many different ways. But absolutely, how you getting good sleep is actually going to be influenced by what you do during the day.
And I can say that just in talking to you at PaleoFX and again coming home and beginning to implement this, I can definitely see a correlation to that. And then it reminded me of my time back in the Peace Corps when I did have electricity, but I literally had one light bulb. And the family that I lived with, we really had no near neighbors, and a lot of people didn't have electricity. So when the sun went down, yes, I had a light that I could read, but everything else around me was pitch black. And then I really woke up to the sunrise. And yeah. I know that's a lot of what you teach in your in your plan, dance plan, which we'll get into, you know, about that. And since implementing some of that, I've coming home the orange lights that you mentioned to me, really having blackout shades and letting the sun wake me up, just some very simple things, and finding times to require myself to shut down the computer, adding Flux onto my computer, which John suggested, and we'll get into that as well. I mean, those things very simply and quickly changed for me dramatically my sleep in just a short amount of time. And so maybe we do want to just get into, you know, what are some of those habits? And I don't know if you want to talk about Dan's plan about, you know, what are some things that people can do to help themselves get some better sleep?
Yeah. So Dan's Plan is a company that I started a couple years ago. It was really in response to a very traumatic experience that I had, which was I was doing cancer research in 2000. My father was dealing with a cancer diagnosis. So the research that I was doing was looking at lifestyle and how that influences the rate of progression of prostate cancer. So, you know, like anyone would do, I tried to use some of the information that I was, you know, studying and learning. It was, and by the way, that clinical trial was looking at 180 patients that had prostate cancer, and then doing things like dietary intervention, stress management, exercise, all these things, and seeing if they had better outcomes than people that just did kind of the standard watchful waiting, where you don't do anything, but you just keep a close eye on the prostate cancer. And so anyway, that was, you know, it was interesting that I was doing that at the time. My dad had cancer. And so I kept trying to share information with him that I thought would help him, you know, have a better outcome. And so I kept giving him information, just throw, you know, kind of like trying to convince him, and nothing would change. And so, you know, he wasn't able to make the changes, even though he would listen eagerly. And so I, after he passed away, I started to study human behavior in a very kind of thorough manner and all the different drivers of it. And I created a behavior change model that was meant to, if you want to help facilitate health in somebody, what would you do? And information is a part of that, but then there's also ways that you can make it a lot easier for somebody to kind of integrate it into their life. And so what Dan's Plan is trying, so that was the model that we created. And then Dan's Plan is help, you know, is basically the operationalization of that. So trying to make tools and systems and frameworks. And the problem that we're trying to address on a high level is healthy lifestyle. All right. That is our thesis, is that an unhealthy lifestyle, or what we're calling a broken lifestyle, is at the root of most modern illnesses. And that's because we have all this new types of stimulation, whether it be from food, you know, sedentary jobs, or different sorts of engaging technology that keeps us up at night. It's very easy to just react in a normal human way, but then live a not normal lifestyle, and that leads predictably to poor health. And so we're trying to address that. So that's what Dan's Plan ultimately tries to do. So we use technology to help to stimulate mindfulness. We have some educational aspects to the program too. It's all free. I totally encourage people to check it out. And some of the things that we do is based off of behavioral change techniques around control theory. So if you look in the literature, the aspects of behavior change that have the greatest influence on getting us to do something or not revolve around some simple concepts of intention formation. So what does that mean? It's like, well, you're setting the intention to do something, and just stating that and articulating it and clarifying it in your mind can be really powerful in terms of whether or not you do it. So a good example relative to sleep is formulating a bedtime. So if you know, oftentimes people have fixed wake-up times because of work, you know, and family, et cetera. So they know they have to get up at, let's say, 7, right? And over time, you can figure out what your sleep need is. We'll talk about that. And then you can work backwards and say, okay, you know, the average is 8 hours. Let's say you need 8 hours, then you know you need to be in bed at least by 11, right? Because while you can't guarantee that you're going to get 8 hours of sleep, what we try to do is have people focus on time in bed. That's what you can actually control. Now, your sleep within that period might change night to night, but you know you're not going to get 8 hours of sleep if you're in bed for 6 hours, right?
Right.
So that's a bit, you know, that's just a super helpful thing that you can do. And so, but the problem is that, you know, at bedtime, we tend to be more impulsive because aspects of our brain are tired. It's easy to kind of get onto the computer start to surf around, and you know, you kind of get lost in there. And then on average, it's easy to truncate a good half an hour of your, you know, of sleep. So if you could have gotten 8 hours, you're now only getting 7.5 or less, actually. And you know, the average we were talking about earlier is 6.5. So that's easy to do, to have that happen to you. And so just having that intention, be like, you know, I want to get in bed by 11 every night. And that number might change, you know, is going to be very personal and individual. But setting that intention and then using some technology to basically help you stay mindful and let you know, like, you know, your goal is to be in bed by 11, but you're averaging over the last week, you're at your bedtime is closer to like 11, you know, 11:45. Well, that gives you good feedback to say, okay, you know, okay, I need to make some adjustments here. And that's a constant process. So, you know, we think of aspects of dance plan as almost like a mechanic for your car or like, you know, the dashboard for your car. You know, if you're going, you know, you've got a gas gauge that lets you know when your gas is low and then you can fill it back up again, or when your you know, your oil light is on. And that sort of feedback helps you keep that car in good shape. And the new technology that's coming out now, where you have, you know, you wear these wearable devices on your body and they passively collect information. We now are in an age where we can do that for our health and our behavior. And so that's a big part of what we do too. And I think one of the reasons why it's so important is that a lot of healthy things are actually fairly mundane. They're not super exciting, but they're really important. And so they're easy to overlook. And so how do you escalate them in terms of like their visibility and their kind of importance in your daily life? So there's a lot of techniques you can use to try to make the mundane more visible, interesting, accessible, tangible, you know, all that. So that's Dan's plan.
Real quick before we, I was mentioning to you as we were sort of touching base about the timing of, you know, chatting today, how after speaking with you, I really was having these troubles sleeping, and I was going to bed at, when it hit 11 for me, I was getting into that tired, wired, and I know not a lot of listeners out there can identify with this, with the adrenal issues. You know, I would kick into this, I would come home sort of tired, and then at 11, there would be this thing, and then I would suddenly get wired, and then I would kind of be up. But I knew that if I went to bed at 10, I would avoid that switch into this wired. And so there was literally a period, and your program probably would have been really helpful for me, but I literally was practically setting my alarm to be like, at 9:30, it is bath time, and at 10, you're going to bed. And I found really it dramatically shifted for me. The big difference, I mean, even though it was that, wasn't so much, I don't think, the hour of missing the sleep. It was just getting into that, when you have adrenal issues, getting into that wired place where, and you can speak more to this about kind of what our hormones are doing, you know, throughout the day with the circadian rhythms and stuff.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, one, our sympathetic nervous system is, you know, produces catecholamines, which are hormones that are alerting. So things like epinephrine and norepinephrine. And as you enter into sleep, the activity of that system, the sympathetic nervous system, drops significantly. And actually, as you then descend into deeper stages of sleep, the activity will actually depress even further. And so when we are up, and by the way, downstream of sympathetic nervous system activity is activation of the HPA axis, or the hypothalamo-pituitary-adrenal axis. And so oftentimes, you know, if people have high, you know, and by the way, what will happen there is you'll have increased levels of glucocorticoids, and then that's going to alter levels of glucose in the blood, gluconeogenesis in the liver, or new glucose formation in the liver. And it's going to, that is, it's basically a stress response to both psychological and physiological stressors. So that is kind of just like the standard physiology of that system. And the way that sleep can influence it is that, well, multiple ways. Simple sleep loss can mean that over a 24-hour period, we have a longer fraction of time that our sympathetic nervous system is activated, and a decreased fraction of time that sympathetic nervous system is basically resting and restoring. All right. And so that also means that you have a higher period of time that your HPA axis is being stimulated. And so that alone is just deregulating the way that our body would like to kind of have a on-off relationship with stress hormones. And so getting 6 hours of sleep per night is basically a stressful situation for the body. And that can then affect multiple organs in a variety of ways. Again, it's, you know, how it crops up is going to be unique to that individual. It's going to be, you know, a very multifactorial process based off of, well, what has the person's diet been like, and, you know, genetics and all the different influences over the course of their life. You can, you know, you're creating a situation that can really exacerbate any sort of pre-existing condition, and can also kind of make one crop up. So that's just the response to sleep loss. And by the way, that mechanism that I just described is also thought to be one of the reasons why sleep loss has such a strong correlation with weight gain. Because if you are basically increasing the levels of circulating glucocorticoids at you know, kind of the baseline level, then it's almost like you're inducing a Cushing's-like syndrome. And Cushing's syndrome is high levels of corticoids, of glucocorticoids, that reliably lead to insulin resistance and also to obesity. So if you give somebody prednisone, you know, weight gain is often, which is a glucocorticoid, oftentimes, you know, people will gain 50, 60 pounds by just being on that drug. And so you're kind of inducing that with sleep loss.
Yeah, and I remember working in the ER and doing shift work and either not getting enough sleep or my sleep bouncing around or night shifts. And I know there are a lot of people out there, at least on the Facebook page, that was asking about, you know, shift work for people, how that affects health. I know that there's a lot of research out there about cardiovascular disease, cancer, all kinds of stuff.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, I'm going to use this opportunity to actually go back to talk about light, because what we're really, you can parse this conversation to think about sleep, in a variety of ways. There's the sleep in terms of actual sleep that you're getting and how much you're getting within a 24-hour period or over a period of time. And then there's also this concept of circadian alignment. And circadian means approximately 24-hour period. And over a 24-hour period, our body and our brain are going to go through this oscillations that, depending on what time of day it is, right? And that means, like, for example, you know, your cortisol levels during sleep, you're going to have, you know, right at bedtime, your body temperature is going to go down. Growth hormone levels are going to go up. Cortisol levels should be low, right? So all of these, this symphony of processes and hormones are all kind of taking place, and they form what are thought to be phase relationships. So the phase is going to be, you know, at bedtime, you're having all of these things taking place. And then that's going to influence things like cell cycle repair and growth and, you know, again, hormone release, et cetera. And so when you're doing a lot of shift work, you're causing, the way that's, you know, what's, and by the way, what's organizing all of these relationships is light entering the eye. So I'll take a moment and I'll describe what's happening there. So we now know that there are specialized cells in the eye that act kind of like rods and cones, and so that they can transduce the light signal into a neural signal, right? And so even though rods and cones were discovered a long time ago, those cells will communicate with the visual cortex. And that way we can take in light into our eye and we can transpose that into an image that, you know, basically represents the world around us. Well, these other cells have similar characteristics. They're called retinal ganglion cells. They will perceive light, turn into a neural signal, but they don't communicate with the visual cortex. They actually communicate with something called the master clock in the brain. And that master clock is an area of cells called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And brain terms are always very long, but they're just usually descriptive of like where they are positionally. And so suprachiasmatic means above the optic chiasm. And that group of cells is very responsive to the light that is coming into the eye. And then what it does is it will establish, as the master clock, it will influence how your clocks are working throughout your body. So we have clocks in every cell in our body, fat tissue, liver tissue, every organ, right? And those clocks are going to be determining the 24-hour process of that cell. Cells don't do the same thing all day long. They do different things. They have periods of rest, periods of higher activity, right? And so that master clock is letting them know what time of day it is, and that's going to indicate their activity, okay? Mm-hmm. So, all right. And so what's happening, you know, so that's a really critical piece to this 24-hour cycle, because as you were saying, Amy, when you were in the Peace Corps, you were living a more natural existence, because you were rising with sunrise and you were going, you know, then, you know, when the sun would go down, that would really influence, you know, your levels of alertness and vigilance. In our modern world, we actually, as I was saying before, that quote from David Dinges, you know, we're now, there's a lot of artificial stimulation that is letting our brains and bodies know what time it is. And so essentially, you could summarize this light discussion is that we're not getting enough bright light during the day, and then we're getting too much bright light in the evening. And that can both desynchronize our circadian rhythms, which leads to cardiovascular disease, cancers, you know, metabolic impairment, all sorts of problems. I mean, system-wide, totally pervasive issues. And, you know, it's how long, and, you know, how long do you have to have desynchronized rhythms? We don't know, but the reason that we do know this is that there's a lot of lines of evidence, and you look at, and there's been the nurses' health study where they looked at nurses who do a lot of shift work over 20-year periods, and they show that their, you know, rates of cancer are like four times higher than the normal population. Their rates of cardiovascular disease are, you know, significantly increased, right? So all of these issues are likely a result of creating basically a state of permanent jet lag. Your body never knows what time it is, and it's always trying to adjust to the right time of day. And so, you know, there are people that still have to do shift work. And so there's some things that you can do. We can talk about that, you know, a little bit later. This is just kind of like the general concept, but for all of us, maintaining what we call a smart light rhythm is really, really smart thing to do. And so you want to get a lot of bright outdoor light during the day. And the intensity of light it's not necessarily obvious. So when you go outside, the light intensity is much greater outside than it is indoors, right? Much, much greater. It's on a logarithmic scale, and it's measured in a unit called a lux. So when you go out, yeah, like the light outside on a fully bright blue day is like 100,000 lux or greater. And indoors, it's like 5,000 to 10,000 lux. So it's like, you know, an order of magnitude lower in terms of the light intensity. So we spend a lot of our time indoors. Like, you know, a lot of work these days is knowledge work, which means you're sitting at a computer staring into a screen. And even though that screen, you know, you're getting light into your eyes, it's still not very bright. So, you know, it's not a good thing to think. So there's a difference between light intensity and then brightness. So brightness is the relative lumosity of an object. A good way to think of it is if anybody has an iPad or an iPhone, if you're looking at that iPad on full brightness at night in a dark room, it's going to feel like it's burning your retinas. It's so bright, right? But if you take that same iPad outdoors and you're in a bright light, you can barely even see it because it's actually not that intense. So that's kind of an interesting concept. You know, it's weird how something can seem a lot more brighter, but it has a lot to do with like just the overall light intensity of what your eye's taking in. And so the point is that, you know, computer screens emit, you know, ever increasingly brightness of light, but they're not that bright compared to outdoors. So if you're indoors and you're staring into a computer screen a lot, you're actually not getting a very significant light stimulation. All right. But then at night when light should be going down, that light, you know, through light bulbs, televisions, computer screens, is bright enough to make your brain think that it's still daytime. And so light can do two things. It can affect your circadian phase. So basically when your brain thinks it's dark and when it thinks it's light. And then it also can directly alert the mind. And so there's something now called iPad insomnia, where people will say, well, I'll just sit here in bed and I'll read my iPad until I'm sleepy. And then they lose a good 2 hours of sleep because the light and the content from the iPad are stimulating enough and keeping the brain alert. So you would feel sleepy if you were just laying there, but it's being masked by actually the content and the light from the iPad. And so, you know, light is very, very important. The things that matter are the intensity, the duration of exposure, and then the wavelength. And that's why we recommend people use, you know, Flux, orange light bulbs, glasses that filter blue light. And I know, Amy, you said you've implemented some of these techniques yourself and they've been beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to hear, you know, what you do recommend for people. I installed Flux on my computer and then I have the amber light bulbs that you recommended. And I mean, it's kind of funny. And I think either John or Drew at Clean had the same experience. I mean, I'm sitting there trying to do work and I'm feeling sleepy. It's almost like that light, whatever that intensity is telling my body it's time to go to bed, and I'm not nearly as, you know, effective or efficient at what I'm doing, but it certainly has helped my sleep. So I'd love for you to address that and kind of give some recommendations for people for sleep.
Sure. So blue light, those cells in the eye that I mentioned earlier, those retinal ganglion cells, they have a different response to different wavelengths of light. So blue light is the most stimulating for those cells. So that means that the intensity of any blue light can be lower and still have a very powerful effect on those cells. Red light, on the other hand, is not very stimulating. So you could be in a room with red or amber light, and it's not going to have an equal effect on those cells. So that's kind of that wavelength intensity balance. All right. So when we wear, the recommendation is to use amber toned light bulbs, which you can find online. There's a variety of manufacturers. You can go to lowbluelight.com. And the idea is that you'd want to use those only at night, right, in the evening before bed. And it filters blue light, right, and it creates the idea of virtual darkness or circadian darkness, right? And so your brain is, your light is entering your eye and you can see, but you're not getting that much stimulation to your circadian system to cause it to adjust. Okay.
I kind of feel like it's dusk in my house, like when I was in the Peace Corps and the sun was just about to go down, in my house, it feels, that's how it feels to my body or how I'm perceiving it. I don't know if that's what it's supposed to be doing, but that's how I perceive it.
Yeah, you're right. So, and that's, you know, as the sun goes down, everybody can think about what is that, how does the color of light change at that time of day, right? Think about it as high noon, bright blue light, and then as the sun is going down, it becomes more amber, you know, reds, red tones, oranges. Well, that signal is something that our body is used to getting on a 24-hour, you know, every day at some point during the day, right? And particularly when we lived outside. So what takes place is something called dim light melatonin onset. So as the tone and the intensity of that light change, the quality of that light changes in a natural environment, then that's a signal to the brain to start to produce melatonin. All right. And so the way that works is there's melatonin is produced through this multisynaptic loop where that master clock will affect the paraventricular nucleus, which is another cell group in the hypothalamus, go down to the vertebral column, up to the superior ganglion. Then it affects melatonin production at your pituitary, right? And so, what melatonin does is it actually has quite a lot of effects on the body. It's a very powerful antioxidant, but it also will affect the transcriptional and translational effects on the master clock. So basically, it helps to, it not only does light tell what time, tell the master clock what time it is, but melatonin reinforces that and also tells the master clock what time it is. And so that is that's something that we do when the intensity of light goes down. When you start to use those goggles, efflux, et cetera, you start to tell your body to produce melatonin, and that's going to strengthen your circadian phase. It's also going to help you start to feel the sensation of sleepiness. And so you're just much more likely to go to bed at a time that's going to allow for you to get a full night's sleep because you're going to feel tired.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's, that's, I think the big, and by the way, for light, during the day, if you look at, how much bright light do you need during the day? Well, you'll get the maximal benefit of light probably in about 6 hours of outdoor activity. But if you bundle each hour and you look at the magnitude of effect from each one of those hours on that total, the total effect, you see that the first hour of light, you're getting like 80% of the benefit. So being outside, and actually it's like a half an hour to an hour, being outside and getting that sort of intense light is going, you're going to get most of the benefit just being outside for like a lunch break, or taking and doing a walk in the morning, getting outside again during lunch, maybe doing an after work walk. You can spread it out throughout the day. It doesn't really matter. And when you do, that's another way to anchor your rhythm, right? So if you don't get very much light during the day, light at night is much more likely to pull your rhythm forward. So meaning that it's going to be harder to wake up the next morning. You're probably going to have more, middle of the night awakenings. It's going to be harder to go to bed the next night, right? You're basically kind of like in this, it's like you've traversed time zones and you've gone from, the California to, Hawaii or to England, right? That's kind of like what's happening is that the stimulation from light is telling your circadian rhythm to shift. All right. But when you get a lot of light during the day, it makes you much less vulnerable to getting light at night. But I think still the smart thing to do is to get, a smart light rhythm across the day. So get bright light when you can. There's actually blue light that you can purchase. I think they're called the Go Light by Philips, and you can put them by your desk. And so if you are indoors a lot, you work, in a desk where there's not a lot of windows, having that active will actually be good for your alertness during the day. Think of it like a cup of coffee, and then it'll also make sure that your rhythm stays anchored. And so it's not shifting around, which, causes, issues with alertness and mood, but then also potentially, cardiovascular, metabolic, cancer risks too. So,
yeah, those are all great suggestions. I mean, since I met you, the three main things that I implemented were making sure I'm outside every lunch. I walk my dog, and now it's nice and warm and hot in Austin, so lots of bright light. And nice. Again, around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I do that every day. I put the amber light bulbs and a couple different lamps in my house. Great. And then and the flux on my computer and finding a regular bedtime. I'm really trying to get in bed by 10:30. And I mean, those three things have dramatically really shifted my sleep for sure. So highly recommend. And they're all either free or, and add Dan's plan onto that, either free or very, very inexpensive. Those light bulbs are really cheap. So, and then I think the flux application was free as well. So basically Everything we've just mentioned is free or almost free.
Hey, Dan, can I jump in? I want to ask you a question. I know Amy had mentioned before as well, blackout curtains. And I guess I'm wondering kind of the mechanism there that when you're using blackout curtains, let's say in a bedroom, the benefit of those is that is it also in the evenings if you have blue light coming through, it actually can still, even with your eyes closed, let's say you're not wearing an eye mask, with your eyes closed, can it still affect and throw off your rhythm?
It is possible. So your eyelids are translucent, and that means that light can pass through the closed eyelid and enter the eye. And we do know, like, if people sleep in a bright room, then that can suppress melatonin production by a good 50%, if not more. And then it can also alert you in the morning. And so, you know, the blackout shades, I think, are useful because they decrease the potential of another type of stimulus, whether it be noise or light, to alert you during the day. So you're trying to create a really good environment to allow for sleep to happen. It doesn't necessarily guarantee it, but you're reducing things that can interrupt sleep. What I would do, though, is if you do use if you do use curtains at night, one possibility, because light in the morning so light at night will pull your rhythm forward, and light in the morning will pull it back, right? And so if you have blackout shades, you're keeping it really, really dark until you open those shades, right? And for some people, that may mean that it makes it harder for them to get up in the morning and then easier for them to stay up at night. And so the way that the thing you should do is, if you're using blackout shades, which I do recommend, make sure that you open them and get a lot of bright light into your eyes first thing in the morning, right? What you don't want to do is use blackout shades, and then let's say you work at home or you don't have a chance to get a lot of light, you go and you're staying indoors. So it's not very intense. That could lead, particularly in certain people, to misaligned rhythms too. So the first thing I do, I get outside, I get 5 minutes of sun in my eyes if I can. I go for, I usually walk my dogs right away. But even if I can't do that, just getting outside, getting some light is a smart thing to do. And I would do that first thing.
Go ahead.
That's great. I was thinking of sort of the ideal, because like Amy, me and my girlfriend here, we use the Amber Lights and Flux and all that stuff, and we have blackout curtains and eye masks. And my question was sort of that transition state, that if we're sleeping without alarm clocks, because that's sort of the nature of our work, you can sleep a long time, especially if you don't set that alarm clock. So since we don't do that, is there a benefit to having some kind of device that turns on lights inside at a certain time, since we're not getting that movement of the sun anymore?
Well, it can be, and I won't get into this now, but the entire way that, actually I will a little bit, because it'll be a little bit tangential, but I think it's an interesting concept and it'll partially explain your question. So if you think about what makes us either alert or sleepy over a 24-hour period, it was really it was very insightful for me when I learned this concept that that level of alertness is influenced by two competing processes. So part of the brain actually makes us sleepier and drives sleep. And then those parts of the brain are counteracted by other parts of the brain that are alerting, right? And so we have basically sleep pressure that builds and diminishes over a period. And then we also have a drive for wakefulness. This is kind of an interesting anecdote on top of it. A lot of sleep medications in the past have tried to amplify the sleep generating processes. So, Ambien acts as an allosteric modulator of GABA receptors, which means that it's trying to amplify this really major inhibitory neurotransmitter to quiet the brain down, right? But they've only been partially effective. And so a new class of insomnia medications are these antagonists of the hypocretin system, which is basically the main alerting system. It's kind of like the symphony conductor. It tells all the other wake neurotransmitter systems when to be on. So now the new medications are actually trying to not enhance the sleep, the sleep side, but are trying to diminish the wake side, right? So they're actually decreasing the wakefulness signal instead of enhancing the sleepiness signal, all right? And that's really kind of mind-boggling when you think about it. But and that makes sense, because oftentimes you might be, I think our big issue now is we're sleepy at night, but then we're artificially stimulated by, again, light or if we're watching a television show or reading a book or looking on our iPad and there's some engaging, interesting content, that alerting mechanism is amplified and it's keeping us up, even though that signal for sleepiness is there, all right? And so if you diminish that wake drive, that's kind of the new insomnia medication that's going to be approved here pretty soon. In fact, it might have just been approved. It's not available yet, but it's exciting. So back to, my sleep in the morning, should I have, some sort of like alarm clock that helps me not wake up? Well, you can certainly use light to help you wake up. And even though you can sleep through light, what light is doing is it's entering into your closed eye and it's affecting, your brain. So it's more one of those things where it's going to influence your sleep-wake cycle over a period of time. And so, for example, with children, like teenagers, that have it's very natural for teenagers to have a delayed sleep phase, which means that, parents are yelling at them at 12 o'clock, go to bed, right? But they are up text messaging, et cetera. It's very normal for teenagers to feel very alert late at night, but they still need probably 9 or 10 hours of time in bed. And so we're ending up in a situation where teenagers are alert at night, but then they've got it, so they're staying up till 1, then they've got to get up at 7 because of school times. And even though they need 9 hours of time in bed or 10 even, they're getting only 6. And so this leads to a situation where they're very tired during the day. They've all of a sudden, at night they become alerted. They're the only time of the day that they're awake is at night. And that is, we're seeing a lot of ADHD is probably caused by, poor sleep. And poor sleep habits. So one thing that you can do for kids is you can have a light bulb that turns on automatically at like 4 in the morning. And what that's going to do is the light entering the eye, remember, it's going to pull that rhythm in the other direction. So that's going to make it so that it's easier for the child to fall asleep at a normal bedtime instead of, 12 or 1 o'clock, right? So so that can be helpful. I would say use your blackout shades, but just watch for maintaining a really normal rhythm. So try to go to bed at the same time every night. You just might have a little bit more vulnerability if you use blackout shades for your rhythm to start to drift, right? So it's easier to go to bed a little bit later every night and easier to wake up a little bit later every day. So just keep an eye on for that and I think you'll be okay. But if you do, you can use those products that turn light on before you wake, and that's going to help, again, keep everything aligned.
I have a question regarding along those same lines. So, my shades are that I do get some, amount of light to where I can tell, and so I naturally wake up around the time of my alarm anyway. But on the weekends, I don't want to get up at 7, even though, I might have gone to bed and still gotten 8-9 hours of sleep. It's just the weekend, and I have something about how I do not want to get up at 7. So I'll put on my eye mask and sleep till 9 frequently, and I'm more groggy. So when I'm seeing the light naturally wake up, particularly if I didn't do something that night, like Friday nights, I usually just go get acupuncture or massage. And so Saturday morning, I could see the sun coming up and feel alert at 7, but mentally I think I don't want to do that. So I put on my eye mask and then I finally wake up at 9 and then I'm really groggy. What am I doing there? And do you not recommend that I do that?
I've certainly experienced that. And some of the sleepiest that I am ever is when I sleep in more. Sometimes you wake up and you feel great, and sometimes it's just like, oh gosh, this day is, just waiting for it to be over because you're so tired.
Yeah, like you slept too much,
Yeah. Well, what's happening is, so as I was describing before, there are those different systems that are driving wakefulness. So, and also promoting sleep. So when you wake up in the morning, you've got this mounting sleep pressure. Right. And that pressure continues to rise proportional to how long you're awake. And now counteracting that is this drive for wakefulness. So even though this pressure for sleep is getting greater and greater across the day, the wake drive, when matched, should keep your wakefulness relatively stable across the day. right? I mean, there's going to be some fluctuations, like a little bit sleepy around, you know, mid morning and mid afternoon. But usually you feel pretty much the same. Like if you're having a good day, that's a good day for that, you know, that whole day. And then, what happens is at night is that wake drive, starts to diminish. And now all of a sudden you've got all this sleep pressure, and that pressure will initiate sleep, and it'll also make it more consolidated. So you're less fragmented, right? So you're waking up less over the course of the night. And then in the morning, you've got very low sleep pressure because you've just slept it all off, and your wake drive is also very low. But then again, when they're kind of in a rhythm together, right? So they're oscillating in a functional fashion that help you stay alert during the day and asleep at night, right? And so when people have, you know, vigilance problems during the day, they're not alert, that means that there's usually a mismatch. So when you've slept in, what happens is there's now a mismatch between your sleep pressure and your wake drive. They're just not as coordinated, right? And that will lead to basically there's a difference between how alerting, how much sleep pressure you have and how much kind of alertness drive you have. And so over the whole day, you stay sleepy because they're mismatched. And so, you know, the fact that you wake up every morning at 7 is good. That means you've got a pretty anchored rhythm, right? And one thing you can do is you can kind of risk it and sleep in, or you can wake up and then you can try to take a nap in the afternoon, which, you know, naps are neither good or bad. It's very, you know, conditional. But they are very good. Let's say if you didn't get enough sleep for that week, a nap on a Sunday afternoon or Saturday afternoon can be very restorative. It can actually really help you get on top of that, you know, that sleep debt that you've accumulated. So yeah, you know, like a lot of things, there's not a lot of absolutes with sleep. It kind of depends on your situation, but these are just some of like the bigger mechanisms that we're kind of working with. So yeah, hopefully that's helpful.
Absolutely. I know that we're kind of getting close on time here, and we really appreciate it. I have a couple, what I hope will be kind of quick questions that I can just ask you, you know, from people on Facebook, if you don't mind, and then John might have something as well. So a couple things that people asked were just, how does one determine their optimal number of hours that they need to sleep?
Great question. So you cannot apply population averages prescriptively to individuals, right? So that means that, let's say I took a sample of 100 people and the average was 8 hours per night. I couldn't use that information to say, therefore, you need 8 hours, right? Because the range might be somewhere between 7 and 9. That's like also an average, and actually an average range, right? So if you need 9 hours per night and I'm telling you to get 8, I'm actually prescribing a sleep deficit, right? If I prescribe 8 and you need 7, you can actually even mess up your sleep a little bit when you oversleep. It can make it harder for you to sleep well the next night. So how do you figure it out? So not only is there inter-individual variability, there's also intra-individual variability, meaning there's variability between people, and there's even variability within yourself depending on your lifestyle. You know, are you sick? What's your stress level, right? You know, and so you're going to have your own natural range, right? So when we're talking about a sleep number, that might be your average, okay? But then again, you know, it might go up or down depending on, you know, what's going on in your life. But one way to think about, you know, if you're getting enough sleep is you can basically subjectively look to see how alert do you feel during the day. Right. And while not perfect, and, you know, I actually have a whole seminar topic where I discuss how just subjective sleep measures can, you know, lead to us misjudging our sleep need. It's still not a bad measure either. And so if you're feeling pretty good and alert and you're not needing a lot of coffee, you know, that's actually one indication you're getting enough. You can also look at your weekend differential. So let's say you get 6.5 hours during the weekend, but then you can sleep until 9, you know, both days on the weekend, 6.5 during the week, and you can sleep in a lot during the weekend. that probably means that a pressure for sleep was building and you're not getting enough during, you know, getting only 6 hours a night. So that's another, you know, way to look at it. But I would say experiment. And then, you know, it's one of the reasons why, you know, I'd say use Dan's plan, right? We've track your sleep, set a goal, and then monitor it. So see, you can see how consistently, what you're doing is you're creating a time series record. So if you monitor it over time, you can see what your levels are. And then you can ask yourself, you're like, okay, I want to be in bed by 11. And you're seeing that you're actually doing that. And you've done it for a month. And then you could say, well, you know, how do I feel? And what I would do is try to kind of work backwards and do a period of time where you experiment and try to get as much sleep as you can. Because what I've often found is that people can feel fine on a certain number. And then if you get a half an hour more, you can feel great. Like you're operating at a different level. So play with it. That's my, you know, those are some things as guides. And then do some experimentation where you allow for a certain, you know, like you to get 8.5 hours of time in bed for 3 weeks. One night of sleep is not going to be enough to determine what your need is. You need to let that settle for a period of time. So that's what I would say about figuring out your own sleep need.
Great. I mean, that just really goes back to how I practice medicine, that we're all individuals, and, you know, kind of trying to throw out a blanket statement there that this is what everybody needs. I think that's really great advice to figure out individually what you need.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one other question that I got was sort of natural sleep aids, like I would say particularly melatonin, you know, and the magnesium 5-HTP. Any harm in people doing those things long term?
You know, I don't really know. I mean, the magnesium one, I'll tell you this, and this isn't a dismissal that these things have an influence, but for sleep medications to get approved, they usually have to surpass a very high control placebo rate. So sleep is something that is heavily influenced by placebo. And so placebo is a real effect. If you take something and you think it's going to work, it can really work, particularly with, you know, with sleep initiation insomnia. And so, you know, I had the good fortune of sitting next to Cliff Saper, who's the dean of the neurology department at Harvard, for a lunch one time. And we were chatting and he said, you know, insomnia is really an anxiety disorder versus a sleep disorder. It's an overactive mind. And we all can have experience it, you know, if you find something stressful or something just really kind of stimulating, it can prevent sleep from happening. And people that have insomnia end up getting into, you know, kind of a bad rhythm with it, where then the insomnia can be kind of this positive feedback loop where the stress of the insomnia makes the insomnia worse, right?
So anyway. I mean, can I just interject? I mean, when I was hyperthyroid, it's the only time I've ever had insomnia. And I really thought, I get how people could commit suicide. It was horrible. I mean, and when you say anxiety, I mean, everything was on overdrive for me, right? Because I had hyperthyroidism. So of course I had all this anxiety, all this stuff, and I would just lie in bed. And then it really was probably the worst period of my entire life. So I have complete empathy for anybody out there suffering with insomnia. Yeah. And hopefully you'll pick up some value from this talk to help with that.
Yeah. So, you know, the bigger point there was that things can influence your sleep that may or may not have like an actual physiologic effect on the alerting or on the sleep-inducing properties. But that's okay. So common things, you know, people do take magnesium. Magnesium, you know, influences like, you know, several hundred enzymes that affect, you know, a lot of different processes, including some neurotransmitters. So it's possible that that could influence you know, sleep initiation. 5-HTP is an amino acid that is a precursor in the biosynthesis of serotonin, which is, if you look at the steps of melatonin production, it goes, you know, the amino acid tryptophan, you know, is converted into eventually 5-hydroxytryptamine, which is 5-HTP, and then into serotonin, and then eventually to melatonin. And so those things are kind of along that you know, the sleep induction pathway. 5-HTP will cross the blood-brain barrier where serotonin has a harder time, will not. And so people have reported that it's been really beneficial. Now, I'll tell you that whether or not it has direct sleep-inducing properties, I do not know. Yeah, so melatonin actually is not a very potent sleep-inducing chemical. It does promote some what's called soporific or sleep-inducing, you know, activity. And there are melatonin receptors on different sleep-stimulating centers of the brain and also on certain wake centers of the brain. So it acts to kind of enhance the sleep induction and diminish the wake-inducing. So that's all good. But again, it's not really powerful. It's better at, again, aligning your circadian rhythm. And so, you know, melatonin production, you don't need very much for it to influence that circadian clock. Half of a milligram actually will be potent enough to do that. But then people will take larger doses, and it's now being explored clinically in doses that are, you know, 5, 10, 50, 100 milligrams, really high doses, just to see if it has, and by the way, it's being explored. It doesn't mean that it, you know, that's beneficial, but it's being explored for things like various neurological conditions, and also even things like cancer too. So yeah, so that's, you know, a lot of people use it, and it's beneficial, and I think that it's a fairly innocuous but also powerful medication and so a hormone. And so I think that taking, you know, I don't think that there's a lot in the literature that suggests that it's really problematic, even to take it long term. But I'm, you know, my bias is always to try to not put a lot of stuff in my body, but then, you know, to use things that at our disposal sensibly. And so, you know, that's kind of an equivocal statement there. But I would say, you know, it does have evidence that it could be beneficial. I think it's always great to try to induce it naturally by using the, you know, the amber lights and the glasses and efflux. So that, you know, that's my kind of statement there. So all those things might be beneficial, but there's not a ton of evidence. The most evidence is in melatonin. That's been studied extensively, but the other two less so.
Well, that was awesome. We really appreciate it. If you want to, I mean, I think a great place to kind of depart, I love to give our listeners really practical things to walk away with. So if you could, you know, give us a list, 3, 5, I mean, whatever you think of things that people can kind of right after this podcast that they can quickly and easily do for themselves to improve their sleep hygiene and getting to sleep, that'd be awesome.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'll say that we created an infographic called Optimize Your Health. If you go to dansplan.com under programs, you can see Optimize Your Health. And we talk a little bit about some of the things you can do to optimize your sleep. So, you know, we want to help everybody live as an intelligent eater, an enduring mover, and a restorative sleeper, which we created, you know, what those terms mean and how you, you know, and how you would basically, you know, what kind of actions are around those. They're aspirational. So for the restorative sleeper, you want to maintain smart light rhythms across the day. And so try to get at least, you know, outdoor light for about a half an hour a day, if you can. If not, think about using a Go light, which is that blue light by your desk. Really important stuff. At night, you want to dim the lights, so the intensity of the light matters, so dim it. And then try to, you know, keep by your bed amber-toned light bulbs, and then also the glasses if you're going to be reading anything on your iPad or Kindle or a book, in bed before night. And try to start to use those an hour or two before you go to bed. 3, set an intention. So what time do you want to be in bed every night? Clarify that in your mind. That's going to, I think, really help you know how you're doing. It's that mindfulness check, right? This is the time I want to be in bed. Am I doing it or not? It's simple, but effective, right? And then, so the two things that we feel are actionable, there's a lot of new apps and devices that are tracking sleep. And I have an Occam's razor approach to a lot of things, which is to keep things as simple as possible and not simpler, you know, right? So a lot of these devices give you feedback, by the way, which is highly questionable if it's accurate or not. In fact, even the most validated ones are not very good. And so but what are you going to do with that information anyway? Let's say it tells you about the amount of deep sleep and REM sleep that you're getting. That's not actionable, right? Because if you do respond to one night of REM, you know, less REM sleep or more, you know, that's not a sufficient amount of information to know how you should adjust your sleep. So what I try to focus on is timing and duration. Am I going to bed at, am I keeping my time rhythm locked down, right? That's light during the day and that's bedtime at night, right? And then am I getting enough time in bed to get the sleep that I need? Now, what happens to your sleep during that time? You're going to have good nights and you're going to have bad nights. But you're not going to get, again, you're not going to get 8 hours of sleep if you're in bed for six. So try to always give yourself enough time in bed to get all the sleep that you can. And then I'd say, you know, use some sort of technology device, because we now have, you know, this new technology like Dance Plan, like Fitbits. They can do some of this tracking for you. So the collection of information is really easy, but then the feedback is very insightful and helpful. And so kind of like, again, with your car, with, you know, gauges and feedback from like oil changes and gas, it just lets you know how to make small adjustments. It's often very easy to misperceive what we think we're doing to what we're actually doing. And so getting that feedback is going to keep you in a healthy place, keep you in that healthy zone. And that is just something that you do kind of constantly. It's very, very kind of like quick and easy. You get that mindfulness check and then you can make adjustments to kind of stay in that good place for you. And that's going to go a huge way to helping you have good sleep. Now, it's not going to solve everything, but there is no condition where poor sleep hygiene, you know, is like the prescription, right? There's no issue, you know, that where the doctor's going to say, well, you know, you should sleep less or sleep poorly, right? So taking care of some of these fundamental behavioral things is going to help everything you do, even though if it may not be necessarily a complete resolution, it's additive and beneficial. And for a lot of people, it's going to be all you need.
Well, Dan, this was really awesome. We really appreciate you being on the call with us today. I think, you know, listeners can take away some really actionable advice there. I myself, as I mentioned on the podcast, have done it, changing out the light bulbs, getting some light during the day, setting my intention of what time to go to sleep, and I'm personally going to be downloading Dan's plan. So I hope you guys take advantage of that as well. It's Dan's plan, and we'll have a hyperlink in the blog. And Dan, I really appreciate you being here. John, anything you have, any final parting words?
Dan, just thanks so much. You gave us so much information today. Really appreciate it.
You guys, thanks so much. I really appreciate it too. And, you know, if there's any follow-up questions that you get, I'm happy to, you know, respond to them. But yeah, I appreciate the opportunity and good luck to everybody with getting good sleep. Make it a priority. Because if you don't, then there's a lot of factors in our modern life that are going to disrupt it.
To stay in touch with Dr. Myers, you can sign up for her newsletter on her website at dramymyers.com or connect with her on Facebook or Twitter at amymyersmd.